Hello, St. Pete. This is Deb Carson, and we've got a really special treat for you today, a very special guest. As an author, I am always thrilled when I get to talk to other authors, and no more so than today, as I'm talking with the celebrated former Pushcart Prize-winning author and former Dartmouth, NYU, and Professor Emeritus from the University of North Texas, Professor and author Bonnie Friedman, who released this past April her debut novel, Don't Stop. Bonnie, thanks so much for taking time to talk about yourself and your book and your writing today.
Thank you so much for having me as a guest. I'm just thrilled to be here. Thank you.
We are just ever so thrilled for you to be with us today. Let's jump right into the new novel, Don't Stop. Writers, they often talk about the importance of an inciting event, the event which signals to readers where the story and the arc of the story begins. The inciting event in Don't Stop appears very early in the pages of the book. The event involves your protagonist, Ina, a savvy, sophisticated, intelligent, 41-year-old New Yorker. She's happily married. She's a respected and tenured university professor and soon-to-be-published author who unexpectedly and impulsively shares a passionate kiss with a stranger, Jack. Now, this action, this scene, would seem to intentionally, naturally provoke deeply felt responses from readers, providing a perfect catalyst for readers to choose to invest in the story and keep turning pages like I did. Mm. And for some, maybe even hold up a mirror to their own story, real or fantasized. So, Bonnie, tell us more. How important is this scene? Did I describe the opening well for you? And how does the scene impact the trajectory of the story?
Well, you know, thank you so much. It's a beautiful description of the novel and explanation, yes, of the inciting incident for the novel, the thing that really begins to change Ina's life. And you're right that people have different responses to it. I wanted, you know, the kiss very much surprises her. In her head, she's thinking, no, I'm married. She feels like she hears the screech of trains. I mean, and then she decides, I want to understand what this experience is. She's been envious of other women who she sees being kissed in doorways who obviously have a more erotic life going on. And she decides, yes, I'm going to allow this to happen and see where it goes. And, you know, interestingly, some readers have told me, oh, I don't like to read a book about a person having an affair, which is a response, I have to tell you, that, you know, surprises me, since so much great literature is about people doing transgressive things. And I think part of why people read is to live out the stories that they don't have a chance to live in their actual lives.
Yep.
Because they want to keep their lives together. So I wanted something that would really, you know, tip forward the action in the book and have this character do something she is surprised she's doing.
Well, that brings up an interesting question, and I sort of had I mentioned it just in passing earlier, but I kind of got the impression that maybe Ina's story, if it might be something that people are reading from a faraway place. I also think that there might be people who the story perhaps strikes a chord, whether it's a lived experience, a repressed experience, or even a fantasized experience with many men, women, and perhaps those of a certain age, and maybe men too. Do you think that's true? And did you think that as you were writing the book? What do your readers tell you?
But you know, what I hear from readers is just what you're saying. And especially that many readers have said, it makes me rethink the choices I made in my own life, what better response? I mean, every time I hear that, and I've heard that many times, I just feel so flattered. That's what we hope books would do for us, to hold up a lens to the decisions that we've made and make us think, gee, am I getting enough from the life that I have, or do I wish I had more? And if I had more courage, would I live differently? Life goes fast.
Right.
You know, am I living the life I've chosen? Ina thinks she's living the life that she really wants. And then she discovers the whole level of desire that she had estranged herself from early on, telling herself, oh, these things aren't important. I'm not going to allow them to really affect my life. And, you know, that's why she's sort of overwhelmed when in midlife, the desires that she's repressed overtake her. Yeah. So she's so surprised because she didn't think these things were really important.
I think it really does resonate with a lot of readers, whether or not it happened to them as a similar story, whether they thought about having it happen and maybe came close to having it happen, but it never did. Now, let me ask you this. Because you set Ina's story in a big place in New York City around the year 2000, how much is Ina a product of the millennium? And if you had dropped this exact plot or even this scene into the women's liberation era of the 70s, or conversely into our current, even more conservative social landscape today, would the core of her story, your story for Ina, change? Or is it what some might view as potentially a conundrum of female desire? Is it simply a timeless
situation? You know, I hope it is timeless. When I said it at the time of the millennium in New York City, which was a time when, I don't know if you remember this, but the stock market was going crazy.
Yeah.
The NASDAQ was so high. And there was this feeling in New York as if there was a big party going on. Unlike today, the people who were becoming wealthy, it seemed like everybody could have a piece of that you could buy a stock and it could do well. There was a general euphoria. And I wanted that to be a force sort of inviting Ina to feel as if there was a party going on. She didn't want to miss out on it. You know that line, like, you don't want it, the parade is passing by and don't want to miss out on it. And so that was definitely a factor. And I think Debbie, if it had happened during the women's liberation time also, she would have felt encouraged to take this risk, and maybe she wouldn't have today.
Yeah.
Since it is a time of, you know, where people want to play it safe and much greater repression, and there's a lot of punishment for women who speak out. We have this feeling that there's the tide is going in the wrong direction for some of us.
Yeah.
So I think the era in which it happened, I did want it to be a factor in encouraging her to take this risk. Yes.
And I know that you she's a 41-year-old woman, so maybe, and I don't think you talked about this, but it made me also think, just as a reader again, she's 41 and this is set in 2000, 30 years before, you know, when she was coming up, when she was a teenager and women's liberation was something that was happening all around her. If anything would have come up like this in her pubescent years or her teen years, surrounded by consciousness raising and women's liberation, would she have more cavalierly done something like this and thought nothing of it? It would have just been something that was happening as she was coming up.
That is such a good question. If she, I think that midlife for some people is a time when they live out the parts of the healthy parts of development that they didn't get to live out earlier. So early on, she discovered doing well in school and getting good grades and being the youngest in her family, she finally had an identity, something that made her feel special.
Yep.
So that she really clung to that. And that's why perhaps, she's a very codependent, nice girl, taking care of her parents. So I don't even know if it would have been possible for her to live out all of, the desires that she discovers she has in midlife. Also, I wanted to say, I think the nature of desire changes.
Yeah.
I think that
absolutely
sexuality changes, and that in midlife, a woman, the experience is much more significant than what happens earlier on, for many reasons. But I wanted to capture some of that too, so that even though she'd had boyfriends when she was in her, you know, teens and early 20s, she did get married at 28, but she'd had boyfriends, but the sex had not been like this.
Right.
It strikes has a much bigger effect on her at the age of 41 than at the age of 25.
I agree. It does. When you think back to your own, to people's own lives as they're reading this, and they reflect upon what was I like 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, and it you're in very different places in your life. And so she had that ability to go ahead and act on her own desires, whether or not it was voluntary or involuntary. It did become voluntary eventually. I want to switch a little bit over to her life as a very accomplished tenured university professor. And I thought it was interesting that Ina's scholarly area of interest is the playwright Eugene O'Neill, about whom she's writing this book. O'Neill's plays are filled with characters torn between who they are supposed to be and their basest, most destructive impulses. Is your choice of O'Neill for Ina's book a subconscious reflection to her own hidden life? And does the stranger, Jack, whose kiss sets off the events that upended and forever changed Ina's life, does O'Neill embody the raw, for lack of a better, O'Neill-esque disruption that shatters Ina's polished and formerly stable professional and domestic world?
Okay, well, that is the most, that is the best question I've been asked. That's my favorite question that I've been asked about this book. That is so insightful.
Well, now that's some high cotton, because you've had a lot of really awesome interviews and questions.
I have had many interviews written and some podcasts, but nobody has put that together. And you are absolutely right. She doesn't know, you know, in Don't Stop, she doesn't know why she has chosen to study O'Neill. She thinks it has something to do with the fact that the mother in A Long Day's Journey reminds her of her mother. But you are absolutely right. O'Neill's subject is the divided self, sort of the late Victorian self, and his characters are often breaking out and saying the heartfelt, kind of crude, libidinal, but true thing that they mean, and then they will withdraw it and say, "Oh no, I didn't really mean that. Forget that I said that."
Yeah.
So I wanted very much to have her learn from him that certain parts of ourselves are inalienable, and you could just pretend they don't exist, and they're going to keep leaping out as they, you know, by the end, she's sort of almost like an O'Neill character, saying the things that she has not allowed herself to know. But that is I loved researching O'Neill. I went to the Beinecke Library and held manuscripts in my hand. I saw his work journals. There was so much to learn about his life. But yes, what your analysis of the power of his characters and that divided is very much something I wanted the book to resonate with. Yes.
Did you consider putting a different author in place of O'Neill, or did you? Who else did you consider, if anyone, or did you always sort of focus on O'Neill for that?
Well, you know, there were other playwrights that I considered. I was thinking of Tennessee Williams or Arthur Miller, the two other great male 20th century, I mean, it's just the greatest, I think, American playwrights of the 20th century. But I have a greater affinity for Tennessee Williams and for Arthur Miller, and I wanted somebody who it would take me a while to understand. So I put him down almost as a challenge to myself, because when I began the book, I didn't understand O'Neill, and I thought, boy, if I'm going to spend time studying this guy, I would like to really learn from it. I'd like, you know, so there was something about his the fact that he was a little obscure to me in terms of understanding him, that was an asset.
Mm. Well, I got to tell you, it is a fascinating read, Bonnie, on so many levels. And I'm curious, how do you feel about how some critics or their ilk, how have they the way that they have characterized your telling of the story as being well-mannered and humorous, while at the same time erotic and explicit, taboo, poignant, even profound. Someone had mentioned it was a narrative about the heart rebelling against the mind. Are these characterizations accurate in your view? And if so, how were you able to strike a balance without overwhelming one facet or another facet of Ina's character?
Well, thank you for reading from those reviews. I do think that they are accurate. I'm not sure that the book is well-mannered. I think she's well-mannered, but I don't think that the book is. I think sometimes, you know, reviewers have to read a little bit quickly, so, you know, they're not going to get everything precisely right. But I think that that is a very good characterization. I wanted to make sure in writing the sex scenes that they were not pornographic. Mm-hmm. I wanted to enter her experience and show how it was transformative and marvelous for her. I wanted to give a sense of that it was actually really quite marvelous for her, without it being a sleazy or a turner or anything. So I did want to write with a certain restraint. Yeah. I was aware of, you know, the challenge of writing a book that has Eros at the center, and yet, you know, keeping it in the mind of somebody, a smart woman, who, you know. So I looked at certain examples that helped me. I read 9 1/2 Weeks, which I think is a very smart and well-structured book.
Yeah.
And I wanted also to keep a certain amount of humor in the book, especially in the first half, for the reader to be able to be amused sometimes by Ina. And some of their reviews have talked about finding the book funny.
And that was my next question for you. I was going to say, you know, you write, there's a lot of humor in the book for sure. And I was wondering if that was a way of perhaps softening Ina, considering what some might, you know, read into her behavior as reckless choices, maybe as a way of keeping readers continuing to care about and rooted in Ina's corner.
Well, that's such a nice way of viewing it. I wanted the humor in there because for many reasons, and I'm so glad that it kept you sympathizing with her and wanting to continue to read about her. I think later in the book, it's less funny as her obsession gets a stronger grip on her.
Sure.
But you know what? For me too, there was a way that making her a somewhat comical character gave me a kind of authority distance on her, so that we could enjoy the plight that she's getting involved with, and just have that slight detachment to be able to view her more closely.
Yeah.
You know, what I do hear from some readers is that they have issues. Some readers feel like the characterization of the boyfriend Jack, they don't love him as much as I do.
He was an interesting character for sure. I want to ask you, this is something I like to ask authors, but don't often get the chance, but I will because of the subject matter for the book. I have a friend who is a memoir. She wrote a memoir, and she published the book about her time working as, she was a highly successful escort in New York. She explicitly wrote in her memoir that she loved that chapter of her life. She made more money than she ever would again, and she had zero regrets. Now, what she told me was she faced massive pushback from publishers when she was trying to pitch the book. They refused the manuscript on the basis that she was not remorseful, or she, you know, there's no feeling of repentance on this, and that because she chose that way. There were a lot of publishers who just turned her away and said, there's no remorse, there's no repentance. You celebrate this part of your life. And she thought, you guys don't really get this. She finally did find somebody who was able to publish the book. But as I read your book, I thought, because Ina ultimately chooses liberation over regret, did you encounter editors or publishers during the submission process who wanted you to soften the story, soften her ending, or did they fully embrace her lack of repentance from the start? And do you think it makes a difference that Ina's story is fiction, unlike my friend's book, who was a true story, was a memoir?
Yes, those are such great questions. I did not face pushback from editors or my agent about the story, but I have had some readers who clearly want me to punish her, and for whatever reasons of their own. It made me think about the first great novel about an affair, Madame Bovary, was considered pornographic, and there was an immediate trial in France when the book was published. And part of the reason was that there was just this moral outrage. It wasn't about the beauty of the writing, and certainly it's not a pornographic book, but it was considered obscene because, she isn't actually regretful, even though she's regretful of getting into debt, which is why she ultimately commits suicide. But she's not regretful about the affairs that she had. And I think that was considered shocking.
Yeah.
So, when we think about your friend's story is, so significant to me. And I think it's true that we allow the characters in novels to have greater latitude than people in real life. And, the zone of judgment can be severe for people who, don't feel guilty about their own desires. I think that's you just explained something very interesting.
Yep. Well, thank you for answering that question. I'm always curious about that. I want to talk about the fact that Don't Stop is your debut novel, but certainly not your first book. You come to this first work of fiction from a world of wide praise for your several works of nonfiction, including your memoirs and many essays, about which we'd surely love to devote yet another segment. In fact, a whole series, but much of your nonfiction work is routinely included in writing and MFA programs, notably your 1993 book, Writing Past Dark, Envy, Fear, Distraction, and Other Dilemmas in the Writer's Life. So much of your own nonfiction has focused on deeply emotional aspects of your own life, including psychotherapy. I've got to believe that in some ways your nonfiction work served almost as a perfect primer for your fiction. But I want to ask, which was more enjoyable or maybe easier to write? And was one more cathartic than the other?
It's easier for me to write nonfiction because I know where it's going. When I begin, I have a certain question in mind that I use the essay to try to investigate. So I think of it as sort of like an artificial limb that lets me reach further than I could without it when I'm writing an essay. By the end of an essay, I know something I didn't to start off with, but it's a more cerebral process. I found writing a novel much more satisfying, even though it took much greater risk and was much scarier. The satisfaction is unparalleled. It is a much greater satisfaction. Maybe because it comes from a deep place. There's one writes scenes not necessarily knowing what they mean, and then later on you read it through, and it's almost like when you have a dream and you wake up and you understand why you had that dream. So for me, fiction is like a zone of meaning that is more intense than with nonfiction, even though nonfiction is easier.
I keep working on a memoir too, and there are days when I think this would be so much better if it was a novel. I could fictionalize a lot of things that I don't want to have in the book as a memoirist. So that's interesting.
Well, you know
that, it's kind of in reverse for you.
That you know, writing nonfiction, you learn something as well. Having to stick to the facts, you know, forces certain discoveries.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, that is very valuable.
That's true. Well, I want to ask, I have two more questions for you. And I want to say, just reflecting on, we just are, you know, in the process of celebrating the country's 250th anniversary. And our American story has been defined by individuals, not unlike Ina, uprooting their lives, crossing boundaries, risking everything to discover who they are and their place in it. And in that light, and in this time, Ina's journey, I felt, was like something into the unknown. It doesn't feel like it's simply a fictional affair, but perhaps tied deeply to an American tradition of radical self-invention. So as our listeners across Florida and beyond reflect on their own family histories and the private truths that they carry at this time in our history, what do you hope Don't Stop might remind them about the enduring courage it takes to try and write one's own story and one's own ending?
Well, you know, that is another really beautiful question. And I hope that I hope that Don't Stop invites people to realize it's worth taking risks. It's worth not staying in a situation that doesn't allow growth. You know, it is worth it. And one of the things that Ina does is she says yes, you know, as almost as a practice to things that initially she thinks, oh my gosh, I don't want to do this. But then she thinks, you know what? If I don't do this now, I might never have this chance. Yeah. And she discovers so much about her own self and what is possible, and a happiness that she didn't think she would ever have. She kind of fantasized about it. She went to movies to experience it, but she didn't think she could have it in her own life. And so I do love you putting my book into the great American tradition, because I do think that that's, you know, one thing that people go to cities for is reinvention. And here, you know, Holly Go Lightly, leaving a small town, coming to New York in order to become the person that she might not have been able to be at home. So I love the idea of the book helping people think about what's possible for them and giving them the courage to make the choices that they in their heart really want to make.
And courage, I think, is a really, really good word for what Ina has and puts to the test, because she finally does sort of, you know, become more self-actualized about her own self and her own life. And it opens up opportunities for those who have not made those choices, or who have repressed those choices, or have just sort of lived in a bubble and are so frightened to explore outside of it. This really opens up, as a lot of stories do. You know, you can do this too. You can do things that you maybe thought about. This may not be your choice, what Ina's choice was, but you don't have to live in the same place, never see different people, never meet different people, never read different books, never go outside of your comfort zone. And I think that's one of the lessons that I find in this book. So I want to say this, where, this is probably my most important question, Bonnie, where can we find and purchase your books and learn where your readers and listeners can attend your writing workshops? And I understand you're a featured speaker at this year's Writer's Digest Conference in New Jersey at the end of this month, and I wish I was going to that. So tell us where we can find you and your beautiful work.
Oh, that is such a... Well, thank you so much. Yes, I'll be at the Writer's Digest Conference. I'm going to be leading two sessions at the end of this month. My book is published by Europa Publishers, Europa Editions, and they have a website. Indie, there's, I don't think, Barnes & Noble sells it. They've been a wonderful partner to me, having the book up front in their bookstores.
Oh, great.
You can buy it on Amazon.
Excellent.
Or I'm blanking on the name. There's a great website for Indie Next website, but I'm not remembering what it is for independent booksellers. But it's easily
I think it's, is it, is it bookshop.com, I think.
Bookshop.com. I love bookshop.com.
Yeah, bookshop.com is great.
Or my website also has links.
And that is your website
Friedman.com.
I'm sorry, say it again.
It's BonnieFriedman.com.
Okay, very good.
So people could, and they could read other individual essays of mine there and get more information about the book.
Okay.
But this has been such a wonderful conversation, Debbie.
Thank you so much.
Amazing questions.
Is there anything I haven't asked you or that others haven't asked you that you secretly wished to be asked?
Oh, what a great... No, there really isn't. I would just say, you know, I so enjoyed writing this book, and I sort of... You know what? I wanted to say that the book also talks about Ina's relationship with her sister and her parents.
Yes.
And one of the things I was trying to communicate was that when you have an important change in your life, in her case, it is discovery of passion, it affects these other relationships too. And she wishes that it didn't. She wishes she could protect her parents from who she is becoming, and she wishes she could protect her older sister from who she is becoming. She's becoming a more outspoken person.
Yes.
She's become a larger person, and she feels bad about because in the past she's been, you know, a very compliant and caretaking sort of person.
Yep.
I wanted to bring up that issue, that ultimately in the novel, the sister is glad for the change,
yeah,
and the parents are glad for the change. They accept the change. But I do think that that's a feature of, you know, when you go through a big and almost uncontrollable experience, you become a different person.
And, you do.
And those who love you often really do want that for you, even if it feels hard.
As much as you're not sure and you're a little frightened about what their responses are going to be. So I thank you for bringing that up, because that really is an important feature in the book that I think is you know, it is really important to the whole story. So Bonnie, we will end it there, although I'd love to continue, but maybe another day. I thank you for being our very special guest today, Bonnie Friedman. Please, Don't Stop, get in your car, go online, buy Don't Stop by Bonnie Friedman, her debut novel, and her other books are fabulous as well. I'm sure I'm about to get them myself, because I want to read more. And we hope that this is not your first and last novel, but there will be more, we hope.
I have one I'm working on. Thank you so much. This has been a wonderful conversation, a wonderful experience for me. Thank you.
Well, for myself as well. And on behalf of Radio St. Pete and our news director, Nanette Weiser, who oversees this program, thank you all for the opportunity to be talking with such wonderful and interesting people. And thank you, Bonnie Friedman. We really appreciate everything that you've contributed today and everything that you're continuing to contribute. Thank you so much, and we will talk to everyone in Tampa Bay very soon. Thanks, Radio St. Pete.